Why is the exposome relevant to health? What is the next frontier in multi-omics integration? And where does the exposome fit in the 5P medicine framework? In this episode, I discuss with Gary Miller to answer all of these questions and more as we explore his work and its impact on research and health. Welcome to Season 4 of the Metabolomist Podcast, where we explore the transformative role of metabolomics and multiomics in advancing the principles of 5P medicine. That is predictive, preventive, precision, population-based, and participatory medicine. I am your host, Alice Limonciel, and this year I will engage with leading scientists and entrepreneurs to uncover how integrative omics strategies are set to revolutionize medical research and also patient care. Join us as we delve into the latest innovations and challenges at the intersection of metabolomics and 5P medicine, shaping the future of research in health. Welcome to the Metabolomist. Today, my guest is Gary Miller. Hello, and thank you for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you.
I always like to ask the guests to introduce a bit their work first, and especially how did you get to the work that you do today? This is always interesting to me. What was your path till there?
I've been studying Parkinson's disease for about 30 years now. Initial work, my background is a toxicologist. I was very interested in how pesticide exposure was a risk factor for it, and did a lot of like animal studies, transgenic mice, cell culture sort of things for many years. But it very much wanted to see these environmental drivers of the disease. And back when I was doing this 30 years ago, we didn't really have a comprehensive way of doing this. And then as about 15 years ago, some of my colleagues were doing high-resolution mass spectrometry, and I was starting to see how much they could pick up in a human biological sample. And I thought that could work out really well, is if you could do this and pick up these endogenous metabolites and the environmental chemicals in people's blood, this could be a way to comprehensively measure how these external factors are influencing a disease. Back when I was at Emory University, I was working with Dean Jones, and he was building up this sort of system to do this in one of our center grants we had. And I was very much relying on his team to do the kind of work we were doing. And then when I moved to Columbia in 2018, I thought, if exposomics as a field, which I'll talk more about, is going to be successful, we have to be able to do it in different laboratories. And so my goal was, could I replicate what we had set up at Emory at Columbia on my own, which was a challenge in that I'm not a mass spectrometrist, like I'm not a chemist. But the idea was that if I recruited the right people and had the right team, that I could oversee this from a management standpoint. So that was really the goal, was to build up a place where we could measure biological samples in a comprehensive way to measure as many of the endogenous molecules and the exogenous molecules that come from the environment.
Thank you. Yeah, and in terms of managing exposome research as a project, I think you've really made a lot of progress for the field. So we will talk about at least a couple of initiatives that you've put together or contributed to. I think this community aspect and this building and managing the progress of the field is an important part that you really make a great contribution to. So you've mentioned metabolomics indirectly in a way. So like you have these analytical ways of measuring both the exposome molecules and I guess the endogenous molecules, we would call them. For people who are not so familiar with the exposome, can you describe it for us?
Yeah, I think when I looked at this, at the initial part of it, a lot of the work in exposomics was more from an epidemiology standpoint. People were looking at external factors like air pollution and things, and all these external factors. I was very interested in what was happening in the body, and that was why the sort of metabolomics approach was very important. But if you're looking at how environmental factors cause human disease, you can use techniques like geospatial things where you know what the air pollution patterns are, or light levels, green space area. So it's not just a biochemical way of doing it. It's a combination of geospatial and the more biochemical aspect. When we started doing this, you know, 10 plus years ago, most of the people in metabolomics viewed things like plasticizers or pesticide size as contaminants, like they were things that were fouling up their system. They weren't looking at them in a biological way. And so there really wasn't a concerted effort to systematically measure those environmental chemicals. And so that was a really big motivation for us was, could we build off of metabolomics and focus more on these exogenous molecules that aren't laboratory contaminants, they're human contaminants, so things that are in our body. But at the same time, like one of the things we had seen is that from an epidemiological standpoint, you can say a person lives in a polluted area, but you want to see the connection to biology. And that's what metabolomics did. So the idea is that if we're running this analysis, we could see the elevation in certain chemicals and in the same sample, see what's happening to the biological pathways. And so that, for me, was so critical in pulling the external to the internal to not just describe the exposure, but to provide the biological insight.
It's a beautiful approach. And often metabolomics is, in terms of omics, is referred to as the omic that's closest to the phenotype, the one that really gives you access to the response of the organism to the outside influences as well as the genetics of the person. But it's wonderful to also have some of those influencers, some of those external factors in the same measurement, in the same sample. So I think it's a beautiful approach to have both together. We mentioned before that you're driving efforts in the community, and there were a few projects that you wanted to discuss. So maybe we can start with the Banbury Consortium. Can you tell us what this was about and how this came to be?
Yeah, Chris Wild coined the term exposome 20 years ago, but not much happened for about 10 years. It was really slow for a while. And then during the last 10 years, many different people started looking at the exposome, and everyone had a little bit different interpretation of it. And so there were actually several definitions floating around. And as we were talking to people at the National Institutes of Health who were thinking about doing more work in this area, it was like, well, we need to have some sort of unified definition. Like, we can't all be defining it a different way. And I talked to some of my colleagues at Columbia. One in particular was Tom Maniatis, who was leading our precision medicine initiative, who had been at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratories for a long time, you know, wrote the molecular cloning manual that I learned how to clone 30 years ago. And he said, what you should do is have a Banbury conference. And so the Banbury Center at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory. And the idea is to figure out problems like these. And so he said, you get about 24 people, you lock them in a room for 3 days and try to come out with some goal. And the goal was the sort of unified definition. We spent several months working on the planning, working with a group at Cold Spring Harbor, bringing a team together. Some of the rules we had was that you couldn't have more than one person from a university because we wanted to make sure we had good diversity. Mm-hmm. We had people that were chemists and toxicologists and computational biologists and epidemiologists, really tried to get a broad spectrum of scientific viewpoints, and then worked on developing what the goals of the meeting were. And so we went through and did this. It was actually in December of 2023. And then we spent several months writing the manuscript up for this. It took a long time to get through the review process and the revisions of it. But that just came out 2 weeks ago in Science. And the idea was to have this unified definition that was very inclusive, that brought the field together, and that funding agencies could point to and say, this is what we mean when we say exposome. And so we thought it was just very important to have that, you know, not just like a top-down sort of thing, but a community-driven effort on it. And so now that it's out there, I think we'll have many discussions and commentaries about it. But our colleagues in Europe who were involved in some of the exposome projects attended the meeting as well, and they introduced it to their groups, and they adopted something a word or two different, but it was the same theme. And so it's a very consistent definition that we now have. And we also made recommendations on kind of what the field needed to move forward in that paper. And that was kind of leads to this exposome moonshot forum coming up next week, is now that we have a very solid foundation of a definition and what we're trying to accomplish, the moonshot forum is like, how do we do it? Who are the partners we need from governmental agencies, from industry partners, from academic laboratories in a very global framework And that's what the goal of this meeting is to kind of lay the foundation for a large human exposome initiative or project, whatever we decide it should look like.
Yeah, that sounds great. And I also love that the Banbury meeting probably served two purposes. So, of course, there's the outside communication aspect where like you provide a definition and a reference for people who may not be experts or who are gravitating around the exposome world. But I guess the big achievement is to make the people who were in that room actually agree on what the definition is, which was probably the hardest part.
Yes. And that was it. That was a challenge, but it was a very fun part of the meeting was that I look back at the definition I was using weeks before. It's very different. A lot of people came in with these very strong held views, but when they heard why certain terms had to be used or other ones shouldn't be, there was like very good collaboration. I don't like to call it a consensus definition because I feel there you're often like you're giving in at some level, but it's a unified definition. And so I think people made sure that their concerns were addressed in it. And we came out with this definition that everyone seems to find acceptable.
Mm-hmm. On a personal note, I find it also always interesting to see how important words are and how they matter, so that you end up really picking the words so that the definition really conveys something more than just the words. It really defines the field. It's a powerful piece of work.
I think some of the challenges for exposomics now, we've seen this in other fields before, is that in a growing field, there's many innovative methods coming along. And in order to have a high level of impact, you have to be able to compare the data across different laboratories. So again, metabolomics has done this very well with many ring trials and things, but exposomics needs more of that. And so the Nexus Coordinating Center that was funded by NIH, this is one of the initiatives there, where we are working on a ring trial and really trying to figure out the best methodology to measure the chemical space we're trying to measure. And so we're not saying that people have to use a certain instrument or method. It's really like, let's send samples out, see how good people can measure, what instruments give the best coverage. And just so we know what you're getting from the different sorts of instrumentation. But the goal is to be able to bring these data sets together. This combination of when you're doing the endogenous metabolomics, getting the level one and level two annotation is fairly straightforward because you often have authentic standards. But a microbial metabolite of a pesticide, you may never have that authentic standard, but we have ways of measuring it and characterizing it. And so, like, how do you work more when you have a level three level definition, or are there ways of making new standards that we need to have? So I think that's going to be a very critical part for the field is to work on advancing many of these methods. Mm-hmm. And this is something we've worked with collaborators, especially like looking at using some more of the GC-based high-resolution mass specs to get different coverage of space. And this was something that Crystal Pollitt at Yale kind of spearheaded this GC working group where we were working with people that were using this similar instrumentation to come to some consistency in our approaches and make sure that we were getting consistent results across that. I think one of the other challenges we have is that many of the very fit-for-purpose things in metabolomics don't always work as well for the environmental chemicals. What do we have to do to make these adjustments in the metabolomics workbench or in metabolites to better capture the environmental chemicals, which often have some of the uncertainty, like you see the backbone, but there's a metabolite that hadn't been characterized. Like, how do you not eliminate that? Another big challenge that we ran into one of our early papers was the push to say, well, if you don't see the molecule in 70 or 80% of the samples, you shouldn't count it. Well, if you're looking at Krebs cycle, I'm with you. I agree on that. But if you're looking at a case control design for a disease and a chemical's causing the disease, you may only see it in 30 or 40% of the samples. And how do you make that adjustment in your standards in that? And that's the guidance that the field needs to say, how do we address that to say that it is consistent and that you apply appropriate sort of rules and guidelines for those identifications?
Yeah, and it's really interesting. So all those challenges that you mentioned now, they really stand in the way of the standardization that is needed in the end it's really interesting because we started with exposomics combined with metabolomics. So when you get to the experimental aspect of it and doing the measurements, especially for exposomics, so let's say you want to cast a broad net of which external molecules could be having an influence. Analytically speaking, that demands a very broad sample preparation of different standards you might want to have in. And so I guess this is a huge difficulty in the field that we also have in endogenous molecules. So I work more with endogenous molecules, and there are differences there, but it's nothing compared to the differences in physicochemical properties, et cetera, of the molecules you want to look at in exposomics.
Right. Yeah. Like the diversity of the chemicals is really quite extraordinary. And I think this is one of the challenges, and it might be something that for the field that we need to have a couple layers of analysis, like a first pass that gets a pretty good coverage. But then based on what you see is that, you know, now I need to do some more TOF analysis or some more Orbitrap or whatever it would be, because you can't run five different analyses on every sample and work at scale. I think we need to really look at large disease cohorts.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really excited to see also how it moves in parallel to metabolomics and how the two fields feed each other, at least on a technical point of view for people using mass spectrometry to do metabolomics. That there are probably many people who work on both sides.
I've definitely seen that people that were working like on more classical endogenous metabolomics, that they, now that they're looking at these environmental chemicals, because they're very good at measuring them. And so I'm seeing many more people try to annotate and identify more of these exogenous molecules, which has been great for the field, just having more people, rather than ignoring those, actually trying to annotate them. And I think we've really seen a great progress because people are seeing, like you say, you know, the metabolomics is the ohm closest to the phenotype. And so if these environmental things are affecting health, it's a great place to be looking.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we're ready to move to the paper we wanted to talk about, or the line of research we wanted to talk about today. So you mentioned that 30 years ago already you were working on Parkinson's disease. Today, you're still working on Parkinson's disease.
Yes.
Because there's still a lot that we need to understand about this disease, and especially the external factors that may or may not, or may contribute to the onset and the progression of the disease. I'm also a toxicologist by training, so also remember working with rotenone to influence like the mitochondrial metabolism and things like this. And so today you're working with different omic methods to look at Parkinson's. And the paper that we wanted to look into in more detail is a paper where with Zhao as a first author, with the title Association of Coffee Consumption and Prediagnostic Caffeine Metabolites with Incident Parkinson's Disease in a Population-Based Cohort, published in Neurology in 2024. So can you tell us in a nutshell how you came about doing this study and what you were looking for?
Yeah, so this was something where, again, when I looked back many years ago when I was working on Parkinson's, we didn't have the techniques to measure these really deep dives into the blood samples. And so when I was contacted by this group in Europe, they said they'd been following the European Prospective Cancer Study. And during that time, many people developed Parkinson's disease. And so these samples were taken in the mid-90s, and several hundred people developed Parkinson's over the next 10 years or so. So they had the blood samples 8 years before diagnosis. So you had these blood samples when the people don't know they have the disease. Your concerns about reverse causation are reduced because of that. But they had biobanked them and they were in good shape. And so we were very excited to get these. It was about 350 controls, 350 cases that had been confirmed by a neurologist. We wanted to do liquid chromatography, gas chromatography on our Orbitrap systems. This was done in collaboration with Doug Walker at Emory as well. And so we went through and did all the analysis, but then we started like looking at the data. And for the first author, who was a graduate student at Utrecht, trying to break things into chapters. One of the first things we were talking about was we knew that caffeine consumption is protective in Parkinson's disease. The more coffee and tea you drink, the lower the incidence. So it's an interesting molecule just from that standpoint. But they also asked people when they entered the study back in the 90s, how much coffee they drank every day. So they had self-report information on coffee. And so in talking to my postdoc, I'm like, well, why don't we look at caffeine levels in the blood? And of course, we know that caffeine is metabolized extensively and that with our new systems, we can measure more than just caffeine. And in that paper, we show we could actually measure a dozen different caffeine metabolites. And I think this is something that's very powerful with these high resolution approaches is that you're not just measuring one biomarker, you're looking at that entire pathway of it. And caffeine gets broken down into paraxanthine and theophylline. Theophylline is a separate medication itself. But it was really amazing to see how many of these molecules we could find to give us this very strong association. And it turned out that the levels we found associated very well with the quintiles of self-reported coffee consumption. So it gave you one of these pieces where we often wonder how good self-reporting is. I think for a diet, it's very limited, but for tobacco consumption and coffee consumption, it seems to be pretty good. And so we did this initial analysis on the caffeine. That gave us very good confidence that the samples were good, that we could measure a lot of different things in there. One of the interesting metabolites we found in collaboration with Dean Jones in a separate project, we were concerned about these lack of standards for many of these different metabolites. And so we actually ran many different drugs and different chemicals through a liver microsome system to see what was generated from that. And so in that study, one of the postdocs identified a novel metabolite of caffeine. It was not in the literature. It wasn't in the databases. He went back with stable isotopic labeling and said, sure enough, this was a new caffeine metabolite. That was one of the 12 we picked up. And it was only in the databases because we deposited it as a known metabolite of caffeine. And that had just happened the year before. And so it was like a really neat way to show that this system of generating new metabolites for future identification worked, and we had this very good evidence from it. Then we went through and looked at microbial metabolites in this population, and now we're analyzing a data set where we were able to identify several hundred pesticides, and again, pesticides are a concern for Parkinson's, and essentially do a pesticide-wide association study in this population. And so we're working on analyzing that data now and going through the annotations. But again, we're able to identify not just two or three pesticides, hundreds of pesticides, and look for these sort of linkages between that. Again, the population having about 700 patients, I think we've seen from other studies, we definitely had some positive hits, but we do need these studies to be bigger. Like I think we need the sort of 10,000 sort of range to really to start looking at the gene by environment interactions and things. But it clearly shows that these approaches work. You can identify a broad range of exogenous and endogenous metabolites. And it really lets us start thinking about exposome-wide association studies.
Absolutely. I see when I look at the figures of the paper, I also saw that you looked at the results. So back to the caffeine metabolites. The results between men and women, did you find differences there? Was it relevant for you to discriminate the two?
So there are differences in vulnerability of Parkinson's. And so we saw some trends, but I don't want to overinterpret that. Women have a lower incidence of Parkinson's disease, and it's thought to be like an estrogenic sort of protection. But we always go through and look at them, male, female. I don't want to overstep where I think we can with the sample size, but I think the main effect was that it was a very good association that corresponded to that self-report, and I think that was a key part of it.
Yeah, for both genders then, but there are also cases where you could find different modes of toxicity or like ways of the disease coming about in men and women or in different subpopulations. It's something that often metabolomics is used for to have subpopulations of Parkinson's or other diseases. So have you had experiences there where you managed to better describe the phenotype or the presentation of the disease to find different mechanisms?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've definitely seen from using mass spectrometry is because you get such detailed analysis is that you start seeing stratification. And you have a disease diagnosis, but they're clustering differently. And what I think this tells us is that most human complex diseases aren't single diseases. And so I'll come back to this on Parkinson's, but we know this from Alzheimer's disease, where we had done similar studies and we use the clinical diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease versus control, found some interesting associations. And then during the study, people identified these blood-based biomarkers of the disease. They were phosphorylated tau, different sizes and things. But those blood markers correlated very well to the brain pathology. So when we went back and analyzed the data using the biologically based biomarker-informed diagnosis, what we found was about almost 20% of the people clinically diagnosed with Alzheimer's, while they had dementia, it wasn't Alzheimer's disease. And so when you separated it out to have the clean biologically based one, we had so many more hits with it. And so this is like what I think is very exciting, is that it's not just about doing exposome-wide association studies on case and control. You can do it against the disease biomarkers that progress and follow the disease. Now, with Parkinson's, what's exciting is that some new of these protein biomarkers have been found. There's some synuclein seeding assays. And now we're looking at some of these studies to see if we can get the Parkinson's disease populations that have these biological-based biomarkers, because I think we do see a lot of Parkinsonism that isn't idiopathic Parkinson's disease. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is something where it gets back to these, when you have a blood-based biomarker and you're doing the mass spec on the same sample that biomarker is done on, it just really pulls in the concordance of the data. And I think it's going to be helpful when we use these sort of biologically based markers of the disease progression in conjunction with the metabolomics and exposomics.
Mm-hmm. And those blood-based biomarkers, do you also imagine them being in the future? So not just metabolites, but also proteins or other modifications or molecules measured with omics?
Yeah, I think that many of these are initially being identified as protein biomarkers, but then we can go in and do the sort of metabolome-wide association study for that protein biomarker. And I really think that while clinically people like having a single biomarker, I don't think biology works that well. I think we really need to be looking at combinations of biomarkers of diseases. Maybe it's only four or five, but the idea is that maybe it's a combination of small molecules and proteins that give you the best predictive capacity of a certain condition.
Yeah, absolutely. I always talk about, like, whether it's metabolites or proteins or other molecules, they don't work in a vacuum when you're in the cell. Like, they all interact with each other. And if you mess up with the pathway, yes, you will see that maybe several metabolites in that pathway change. Maybe the expression of a few proteins changed. Maybe there's a genetic mutation linked to that or some epigenetic changes linked to that. But all of those things are changed together. Biologically speaking, it makes a lot of sense to put those layers together and then pick those different points out of the different omics.
Right. And I think when you're using an omic scale discovery approach to find those biomarkers, and you use proteomics or mass spectrometry for that, and you have the metabolomics and exposomics, it doesn't mean you have to use all of those techniques in the clinic. Because if you could go to a lateral flow assay or something, there's only five or six things you have to measure. In a discovery view, you want to be as wide open as possible. But when you get into the clinical application, it could become a much simpler sort of assay that might use aptamers or something to find a combination of protein and small molecules in a device and not even need the expensive mass spectrometer.
Yeah, or even like if you're based on proteins and metabolites and also exposomic molecules, you could use mass spectrometry and then specifically look for those with the exact same method. So there are many ways that this can work, especially for all those complex diseases, whether it's cancer or Parkinson's or autoimmune disease. We're still at the stage where we need to characterize them better to understand the phenotype better, to understand the disease better at the molecular level before we can really compartmentalize into different ways of detecting or predicting response to treatment and things like this. But we are on our way. So this is why we have these discussions, exactly, because these are the really interesting things that we're doing with those omics.
Yeah, I mean, I think we are in this sort of multi-omic era now, right? Like we've got genomics really good, but one of the challenges is the analysis of these other omic layers. And for many years, the statistical geneticists were the one that were focusing all that genetic data. But now we need to recruit them to help us with integrating that with the proteomic and the metabolomic and exposomic data. And I think that's going to be one of the next frontiers is how we integrate the multi-omics. Because right now I feel that most multi-omic analysis is parallel omics, like where people are doing them, but you're not actually computationally pulling them back together, which is what's happening in a biological system. And I think with some of the new AI approaches and stuff, it'll help us do that to really get to a integrated multi-omic analysis.
Mm-hmm. And you maybe know that I'm a big advocate of like interpreting omic data and metabolomic data really to understanding the biology, like to the level where you really understand what's happening in the experiment. Do you still see a place for the human bioinformatician or biologist who is interpreting the data, or do you think these will all be replaced eventually by AI?
I'm a huge advocate of study design. I think that we always need to have people that are helping ground these. Like to me, like AI is more about enhancing what we do. It's not a replacement. I recall you go back, 30 years in graduate school sort of thing, that always being questioned, you had a kit to do some analysis. And the question is, what's in the kit? How does it work? The AI models right now, we often don't know how they work. And it's important to understand these connections. And so that's why I do think we need to have very strong biostatistics and bioinformatics as we move forward with this and not just blindly follow an AI model.
Yeah, absolutely. I fully agree. To close on the Parkinson's topic, I'd like to look into the challenges that came about in the paper we discussed or in the overall field, what needs to be tackled or what you've managed to solve as well that can be inspirational for people who are listening to us.
Yeah, like I feel like a lot of the technical aspects of like what we do with mass spectrometry and brain imaging has been going very well. But one of the concerns with a human disease like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's is by the time the individual is diagnosed, the disease has been going on for decades. And so even when you do have earlier samples, the person may not know they have the disease, but it is going on. And so it gets back to our need to have longitudinal studies that really go back far. And it's something where, even like some of the biobanks we have, they tend to enroll adults. And so you don't always get back far enough. But I think this is something where we have to think about the life course standpoint of many of these diseases. And it gets back to that study design and recruitment where we have access to samples that let us ask those questions very early in the disease. Like, and I think this is a challenge for many conditions where by the time you're diagnosed, by the time you have cognitive decline in Alzheimer's disease, it may be too late for a particular intervention to work. But if we could identify it earlier, because the biology is occurring, and I think this is where the mass spectrometry is so powerful, is you can detect these signals earlier and allow earlier intervention. That's going to be critical for many degenerative type conditions.
I think that also brings it back to one of your first points that you made about standardization, both for exposomics and for metabolomics. So when you have a longitudinal study like this, where you collect samples for 10, 20, 30 years, you need to also have methods that you can reproduce later on and that you can compare over time. So this is also a critical point to enable those studies to be useful.
Mm-hmm.
So that takes us to one of our last points. So this year, the main focus of the podcast in this fourth season is Fifi Medicine, where we discuss preventive, predictive, precision medicine, but also population-based medicine and participatory medicine. So which one do you feel closest to and where do you think your work is progressing us, is making us progress towards 5P medicine the most?
So I'm going to have a bit of a cop-out answer on this because I think all of them are very important. And as someone who sits in a school of public health and thinks about population and prevention being very critical, I also think that the sort of predictive value and the precision things are all there. And so I'll touch on each of these things is that mm-hmm. this idea of this earlier identification can very much help with that prevention. And when you can do the sort of exposomic analysis to identify what sorts of factors are influencing a disease, there's things individuals can do, and there's things that policies can be changed. I think it's very important to think about how we prevent things at a population scale. I guess that's where you get the biggest value. But at the same time, I think when we think about at an individual level, the precision is very important, is that we know people are different. People respond different to therapies, their disease progress at different rates. And I think our blood samples tell us a lot about that. And so one of the projects we have now that's funded by ARPA-H is focusing on individualized pharmacology. And so the thinking was that we know what pharmacogenomics tells us, that we see some genetic variants impact how some drugs are metabolized, but it's unable to explain all the variability. And so we thought, what if we went in and used the mass spectrometry to measure all of the drugs and drug metabolites, all of the exposome molecules, all of the endogenous molecules, and see if we can see why people are not responding well to therapy? Like, so what, why are there non-responders in a clinical trial? And so most, for the most part, companies are doing this where they're testing their medication. But in the real world, I think 20% of the U.S. population takes five or more drugs. But no one looks at those interactions because they're made by all these different manufacturers. So what we decided to do is to go back to that drug metabolite system that we were using at Emory, and we're going to go through the top 1,000 FDA-approved drugs and generate all their metabolites, and then we'll have those as reference material, and they'll be in the databases. And then we're studying thousands of samples from different clinical trials from our partners at the Mayo Clinic and trying to go through and see if we can determine those people that respond well or don't respond well, how blood levels are changed, and how much of that is due to these environmental exposures, and how much of it is due to the genetic sort of factor, because we'll have the genetic and the environmental part. And so that's like where the precision could become very important in that. But at the same time, it might be important for that individual, but it also might help redirect drug development to find a drug that is more consistent. So I always think about studying this from an N of one to a million, that I'm always thinking at this precision level, but also at the population scale. And then on the participatory part, is exposomics empowers people to think about their exposures. They can wear monitors and personal devices that can track things. They can look at data about air pollution levels in their neighborhood. They can look at mold levels and things. I think it's a really great place to engage people with their own environment and how they can improve their health by optimizing that. A lot of these things are out of our control, but that's also where we can work with policymakers to improve things, to reduce exposures to many different toxic factors.
Yeah. So I guess this is where you see the biggest impact of metabolomics and exposomics in the next 5 to 10 years would be in that context. Or is there an even more precise or more detailed aspect that you see really is coming up?
I see multiple avenues here, is that if we were able to identify that an exposure phenotype of an individual made them less likely to respond to a certain drug, that you made decisions on prescriptions based on someone's exposure profile, that could have a huge effect across many different diseases. But at the same time, if you're thinking about if you can use these sorts of approaches to make people take better care of their own health, that could actually have a bigger impact. And so I'm not sure where the bigger effect is going to be, but I think that the more we understand the influences of our own health, that can be very empowering to people. Try to minimize their exposures to plastics and minimize their exposures to pesticides and air pollution and optimize their exposure to the positive aspects of our health.
Mm-hmm. And maybe the Exposome Moonshot Forum is where we're going to discover where is the greatest hurdle to achieve this.
Exactly. Looking at the challenges and opportunities and how we move things forward.
Yeah, I really look forward to this and also to the outcome. It's going to be interesting. So for anyone listening, I encourage you, by the time you will listen to this, the meeting will have happened. and there will probably be some conclusions already and some roadmap that will be shared and a lot more work after that. But keep an eye on this project because this is really going to lead the field in the next years. So I think it's time for our last question. You know what it is. What is your favorite metabolite and why?
So DOPAL, D-3,4-dihydroxyphenylacetaldehyde. So DOPAL is a metabolite of dopamine. While I'm saying it's my favorite, I actually want to avoid it at all costs. We usually think about dopamine metabolism and DOPAC as being one of the major metabolites of it, but it monoamine oxidase converts it to DOPAL. It's a very reactive intermediate aldehyde that I think is very much responsible to the damage to the dopamine neurons in Parkinson's disease. And much of my work in the laboratory for the past 20 years has been focused on keeping dopamine inside the vesicle where it avoids this enzymatic degradation and oxidative degradation, because dopamine itself, again, is very reactive. And if it's in the wrong place in the cell, it causes a lot of damage. We actually have a drug development project right now that's looking on improving that storage of dopamine in the vesicle to keep those DOPAL levels as low as possible. It's one that I'm most afraid of, but it's still one that I think is very important, because if we can reduce the levels of it in the brain, that we can slow the progression of Parkinson's disease.
Fascinating. Thank you very much. And thank you for taking part in the podcast. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of The Metabolomist, where we uncovered new ways in which metabolomics and multiomics are driving breakthroughs in 5P medicine, the powerful framework that's shaping the future of healthcare. If you enjoyed this conversation and want to stay updated, subscribe to our newsletter at themetabolomist.com to be the first to know when our next episode drops. Until then, I hope you get to keep exploring the fascinating world of metabolomics.